The meeting will come to order, please. And we don't have a, do we have a quorum yet? I don't think so. 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, 10? Yeah, we do. Let's look over the minutes, and one thing that is incorrect is that we did not note that Representative Brandon Peterson was excused. So that correction will be made. Are there any other corrections? Seeing none or hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The minutes are approved as corrected to show that Brandon Peterson was excused. We were just talking about you last meeting, Representative Peterson. We're happy to have you today, and how's the baby?
Doing well. Everyone,
you know, I don't
well.
Know, members, if we ever announced in this committee that Representative Peterson is a new father, and he has a darling little baby daughter, and maybe Representative Peterson, you'd like to say how everything's going at home. Representative Peterson.
Yeah, everything's going well. My wife's in good shape now. She's made it past the first 2 weeks, so she can drive, and the baby's healthy. We were at the doctor yesterday. She's 9 pounds, 11 ounces,
Ooh.
So she's heavier than she was when she was born, which is a good thing, I'm told. And we're getting some sleep, so, I mean, I guess that's a good thing.
Key.
Oh, it's Paisley Jane Peterson is her name.
Getting sleep is key.
So.
I do not see Representative Dietrich here yet.
There she is.
So DNR, will you come forward? And Representative Dietrich, will you join us at the testifying table? Members, we are hearing House File 206 today, and we will be sending it on to the Committee on Government Operations because several years ago, and I know Representative Greiling remembers this, and others might as well, Representative Segrin and Representative Socorro took on this task, and I think a lot of it was motivated by Representative Greiling, Representative Rukavina. We had been struggling with what was happening to our permanent school trust fund land and where was the investment, and we raised, and especially Representative Rukavina, raised some very important questions about were we getting the return on that investment, or was it going some other place, you know, i.e. maybe the DNR? And were they aggressively looking at how to make sure that we knew that the mineral rights we had and other, like the forest land and other areas, were bringing us a return? So we began a mission, Representative Segrin, Representative Socorro, I was involved in that, Representative Greiling, and others, as I said. And then Representative Dietrich took this on, and when I attended the meeting, and she did marvelous work, by the way, Representative Dietrich has to be applauded, as does Grace, I still call her Schwab, Kelleher. Grace Kelleher, because they really stayed on this the last 2 years and have done actually yeoman's work. But when I attended the meeting in December and realized, of course, now the majority was changing in the House and we were going to lose this institutional memory, which we'd already lost in part with Representative Segrin going to the Department of Education and Representative Socorro retiring, that we probably should consider having minority members, whatever party they are, on this committee so that we have someone who keeps remembering what's going on and, of course, keeps an eye on the DNR. So I suggested that Representative Dietrich draft this language. She did, and I thank her. And so today we're going to hear her bill. She has an amendment as well. So Representative Dietrich, I will move House File 206 to be before the committee and to be recommended to pass on to the Committee on Government Operations. Welcome to the committee, and you probably want to move your amendment, correct?
Yes.
So I'll move the A1 amendment on behalf of Representative Dietrich to be inserted page 1, line 24, after superintendents and the member with expertise on school finance matters, and that will be, I believe, Representative Dietrich. That's from the department. Is that correct?
The amendment.
Yes.
Actually, it was from House Research. They noted that we had erred in not including that.
So maybe I should ask Ms. Larson, one person with expertise on school finance matters, is that going to be someone from House Research or someone from the Department of Education, or is that up in the air? Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, who it actually is, I do not know. The point of the amendment is to indicate who is responsible for appointing that individual with expertise in financial matters.
Very good. Very good. So, with that, all those in favor of adding the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Representative Dietrich, will you explain your bill, and then we're going to hear from the DNR.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to give my appreciation for your words and introductory comments. You are right, we have been refocusing our energy on school trust lands, and so this bill is just one of those pieces to the bigger puzzle. First of all, House File 206, basically what it does is it adds two people to the advisory committee. And the DNR will talk, I think, a little bit about the advisory committee, but the advisory committee was put into place over 15 years ago to advise the DNR on school trust lands issues. And so what we have found after chairing the advisory committee for a year, what we began preparing for the transition in the change of leadership, and what we found is that we needed to have some continuity and a better transition period. Otherwise, we always end up with this, as the chair mentioned, this lag of trying to catch up and learn about school trust lands and all that type of stuff. So what we believe will be a great addition to the advisory committee is to have two minority members, one from the House and one from the Senate. We just think that will be create a better transition when we do change majorities, and provide more expertise of the previous year's agenda to help that agenda flow into the next year's. The other thing that this bill does is that we realized in this transition that the statute was silent on the terms for the members who are already on the committee. So what that does is it just clarifies the terms and the appointments. Mr. Shepherd of House Research has been involved in this bill, and he, just because some of the language that we use in this body gets really confusing, I felt really good about the fact that he needed to create a spreadsheet in order to follow who is on the committee and how who is the appointing authority, what are their terms, and when and how do they become removed. So you have one of those, I believe, in your packets, so you might want to refer to that as you evaluate the bill. The other thing that this bill does is it adds a member with education finance experience. And what when the chair asked what who would be appointed to that, what would need to be, what we hope is that they will have knowledge of school trust lands and knowledge of education finance issues. And the reason we want somebody with strictly education finance experience is because I believe that they will be at the table advocating on the behalf of students, and that is the one thing that I want to really emphasize. This advisory committee is in some role being the trustee for the school trust fund, and so we all need to be acting in the best interest of students. But sometimes when your area of expertise is forestry or mining, you get a little clouded in your perception. So that is the reason that we want to make sure that somebody with expertise in school finance and school trust lands is on the committee at all times as an everyday working member of this group. So with that, Madam Chair, I will close my comments on House File 206 and stand for questions.
Representative Dietrich, we do not have that handout, so if you could give it to Bill or Megan to copy, and members then can see that schematic that Mark Shepherd prepared. Thank you. Representative Greiling, a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dietrich, in regards to the response that Ms. Larson gave, I think it is key who is appointing that person that's got the expertise in education. And if it's in the bill or the amendment, I don't find it. So shouldn't we be adding that?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, if you look on in the bill, House File 206, page 1, line 24, after the word superintendents, the new language is being inserted to say, and the member with expertise on school finance matters, and then continue to read, shall be appointed by the Commissioner of Education.
Oh, never mind.
Thank you, Representative Greiling, for calling that to our attention. We always need to see the detail and understand it. Let's move then to the DNR. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed to give us a 101 version of permanent school trust fund land.
My name is Dan Rourke. I'm an attorney with the Lands and Minerals Division of the Minnesota DNR. I also do a lot of work with the Permanent School Trust Fund Committee. I'm going to give a brief overview of what the school trust lands are, then I'm going to get into the history of the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee, the past and present of that, and as we go, feel free to ask any questions. So, first of all, the school trust lands, the DNR manages about 5.5 million acres. 2.5 million acres of that is school trust land, and there's an additional 1 million acres of minerals, so there's 3.5 million acres of minerals that we manage. As stated in Minnesota Statutes 127.8.31, the goal of the permanent school fund is to secure the maximum long-term economic return for the school trust lands while managing the lands with sound natural resource conservation and management principles. The school trust lands, I said there's 2.5 million acres and a million more of minerals. The school trust lands were granted at the time of statehood. In each township, Section 16 and 36 was granted to the state for the use of the schools. There were some additional federal grants, the swampland grants, internal improvement grants, that were also rolled into the school trust fund via the Constitution. The school trust fund, the proceeds from the school trust fund come from primarily from the mineral resources, from the leasing, the rents, and the royalties on the iron up in northeastern Minnesota. The next place where revenues comes from would be from timber sales, and then there's also some revenues from leases, licenses, and easements, and there's a few other small categories where the revenues come from. Most of the land in the southwest part of the state was sold very quickly after it was granted. In the farmland where the farmers could get out there and begin producing, that land was sold early on. Most of the school trust land now is in the northeast part of the state. The proceeds from the school trust land goes into the permanent school fund, and that is invested by the State Board of Investment. The State Board of Investment invests that approximately 50% into domestic bonds, 50% into domestic stocks. There's a little bit of a cash component to that as well. The interest and dividends from those investments is then distributed to the schools on an annual basis, I believe. Now I'm going to go into what the committee does. The committee is laid out in Minnesota Statute 127.8.30. I believe that's the statute that that is looking at being amended. And the role or the duties of the advisory committee, as stated in this statute, is to review the policies of the Department of Natural Resources and current statutes on management of school trust fund lands at least annually, and shall recommend necessary changes in statutes, policy, and implementation in order to ensure provident utilization of the permanent school fund lands. So the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee was established, I believe it was in 1982, and at that time there were seven members, four legislative members and three school members, the same three school members that it has now, the superintendent and non-metro, or the commissioner, a metropolitan superintendent, and a non-metropolitan superintendent. At that time, from the beginning until more recently, the The committee met about once a year, primarily to work on exchanges. One of the roles of the committee is when the DNR does internal land exchanges, they have to act as the trustee. So that was the primary role of the committee until recently. I believe in the 90s, there was a lakeshore lease lot exchange, and the committee was very active in that process. Other than that, they occasionally asked for a revenue report. Other than that, there wasn't too much interaction or too much activity with the committee. In 2008, 127A30 was amended, and it added a number of new members. That brought it up to 10 legislative members, depending 10 legislative members or 7 legislative members, depending which party has the majority. The same 3 people from the schools, 6 experts, one in forestry, minerals and mining, real estate development, renewable energy, finance and land management, and one with expertise in natural resource conservation, and then there was one non-voting member. The 6 experts and the 1 non-voting member are appointed by the commissioner of the DNR, and the education people are the superintendents are appointed by the commissioner of education. For the last 2 years, the committee has been very active. We've had some good discussions, a lot of presentations by the DNR and MMB and the State Board of Investment, educating the members on it, and I think a lot of the members really appreciated having those discussions. The committee has also set up subcommittees to do some of the work of the committee, and those subcommittee chairs will, it seems to be at each meeting, will report back what type of activities they've been doing and what type of meetings they've had. That's a quick 101. That's all I have. I can take questions if anybody has some.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bork. Are there questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the chart, I'm just curious. Give me the background or the reasoning why DNR experts also are voting members. Why are they not simply advisors?
Mr. Bork.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, you know, I don't know the history of how that developed. You know, all I can say is that's the way that the statute was created, and I think it was intended to be, you know, a joint legislative and citizens committee.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Benson, they are not members of the DNR. They are just appointed by the DNR. They have, for example, one of those, the members is former Representative Gene Miriam. And he has expert. He is a former DNR commissioner, but he has a lot of experience in the area of mining and forestry and that type of thing. So they are appointed by the DNR, but they are citizens with expertise in certain areas as voting members.
Representative Benson, follow.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that response. But it seems from last session we were discussing the difficulties in finding where the resources being generated by the school trust lands are coming from, that many of these decisions were being made by the DNR, which turned out to be sympathetic to the needs of the DNR. And even though these experts are appointed, couldn't we assume that their interests would parallel those of the DNR?
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Benson, I will never sit before you and say that this advisory committee has been highly effective. In a 10-year period, at one point, they met 10 times. When they are supposed to be providing oversight and advice to the DNR on the management of our school's assets, school trust lands, meeting once a year is not adequate. So I don't think it is necessarily the makeup of the committee. In that particular section. So I'm going to go back to my original comment. I think that this advisory committee gives the legislature a false sense of security. You do not have the ample time to get the whole picture of the school trust lands and look at all of these individual issues and follow the forestry certified costs, the mining certified costs, and the money going to the trust fund, and then is all that money going to the students? So this this is a piecemeal approach. This is something that we ought to do because it is the right thing to do. But as you might know, I have several other approaches to school trust lands, and I really think that the children of this state deserve one person who and one agency that is totally dedicated to the issue of school trust lands and the land that the children of this state own would be able to be managed specifically for the beneficiaries of the state, which once you enter into a trust relationship, that is supposed to be your primary focus and mission. And there are some that would say that the DNR has an inherent conflict of interest in managing the school trust lands because they are to be managing for conservation and the environmental concerns, which is true, and that is very true to their core mission, and they do a very good job of that. But school trust lands are different than public lands. They are to be managed with a different mission.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so we looking at this chart, I just want it really clear just to make sure there's no misunderstanding. Are the is the total number now of voting members on this commission equally balanced between DNR and non-DNR, or which of the two, if they do, have the majority?
Representative Dietrich.
The DNR does not vote. Madam Chair, Representative Benson, the DNR does not vote. They only
I understand it. I'm talking about the experts and...
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Benson. I don't know if there is an equal number now or not, or if we...
Representative Dietrich, we will have more legislators since we have the two minority members, and then we have the expert... I think we definitely will. If we attend the meetings, Representative Benson, we will be in charge.
All right.
But so we did not have a quorum at the first meeting, and so that's why we have to make this issue more important to this committee and to the Finance Committee and the Environment Policy and Budget Committees as well, because this is for the students of our schools.
Yeah.
And if we don't stay on top of this, we will be left behind. But I think if we attend meetings as we're supposed to, and Representative Keel will be my designee, I think that we will have the majority vote.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a solid number, however, on in response to my question? I'm just concerned that those experts who many times parallel interest to the DNR may have equal or greater voting power on this.
Well, members, Mr. Rourke, why don't you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, currently there's seven legislators on it, three people from education, and six appointees of the DNR, seven with the non-voting member. So it's six voting members of DNR appointees and versus 10 that are not appointed by the Department of Natural Resources. That being said, the members, the expert members, have been the ones that I think have been in attendance most frequently.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Dietrich, why don't you comfort the committee by telling them how involved the experts have been? Will you comment on that, please?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. The experts have been very faithful in coming to practically every single meeting, and in fact, they are now part of the subgroups also, and they are, once again, very faithful. And, and I will say, since we have this new energy around this committee, we have been very careful in educating the people who sit on this committee, and in fact, we have had the Attorney General's office come and talk about trust law and what is the when you are the trustee for a trust, what are your obligations. And there were many people around the table who had been on this committee, DNR appointed or not, that just said thank you for framing that issue for us, because now we really understand why we are here. It is to manage the trust for the trustees, for the beneficiaries. And so you have a strong fiduciary responsibility, and they take that fiduciary responsibility very seriously.
Very well said, Representative Dietrich. Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rourke, a quick question. The DNR owns this $3.5 million
acres, right?
Excuse me, Representative Dietrich, clarify that, please.
The students of the state do.
Students of the state do.
Yes, and it's in the Constitution.
Yes.
This is the one thing that we have to just be very careful about. Public lands are different than school trust lands. School trust lands are to be managed for the benefit of the school districts in this state forever. And different public lands are owned by the state, managed by the DNR also, though.
Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so the students own the land.
Yes.
Okay, so what if the students sell the property and put it back on the tax rolls? Because the math, if you do the math in this thing, it's $6.50 an acre. And I'd love to own land in Minnesota and pay $6.50 an acre. Is it possible to sell that land and then dedicate the property tax back to schools?
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Land has been sold.
At market value, I will say.
Yes, Representative Dietrich. They are under public. The land sales have to be publicly auctioned. So there are some states, though, who have misused their funds in that way, that have given sweetheart deals to different agencies for the school trust lands. But upon statehood, we needed to dedicate two sections of land of every township, section 16 and 36, to the children of this state. So if you can imagine a picture of the state with those two parcels of land in every township dedicated to the students of this state, it's a very checkerboard type look. And so many of those lands have been sold already, but the majority of where we have them are still up in northeastern Minnesota. And the money from those sales have gone to the permanent school fund, and that fund generates interest and revenue, and that is the money that is sent to the schools. But up until 2008, that money was then being subtracted from the general fund. So there was no net gain to the students. So nobody was paying attention to the fund, and nobody was really putting pressure on the advisory committee. And in fact, I blame the legislature for this. We have also passed many laws that have allowed the DNR to get reimbursed of many of their expenses, and that's a whole other issue that we don't need to talk to today. But from a land sale, money revenue goes into the permanent school fund, and the permanent school fund has about $700 million in it. It generated about $26 million in interest and revenue in 2010, but 2010 was the first year that we sent that money to the schools, mm-hmm. and it stayed in the schools as over and above revenue.
Thank you.
Excellent explanation, Representative Dietrich. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roark, with the checkerboard, sections of 16 and 36, I know I have some in my district, section 36, isn't it very difficult for the DNR to manage those separate parcels that seem to be quite, non-contiguous, I guess I would say? How do they do that? Is that a problem, or is that not something that we worry about too much?
Mr. Roark.
Madam Chair, Representative Crawford, there are, like you say, there is the checkerboard pattern of 16 and 36. There are other lands within there. It's not just 16 and 36, because I mentioned the internal improvement lands and the swamp lands. But I think it's accurate. When you have lands in different places, it's going to, there may be an added cost there, because you have to go back and forth between those. If all the land was consolidated in a good resource area, you could generate some good revenues off of it, and your costs would certainly be reduced. One thing with having it in the checkerboard pattern is, you don't confine yourself to one area. You go out and hopefully you have some good resources on that checkerboard pattern to generate revenues from.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, consolidation has been a goal, and in fact, I don't believe you were here last year, but we passed a House resolution that would take the school trust. The children of the state own 86,000 acres in the Boundary Waters Canoe area, and that land is not able to generate revenue. And we have, because of it being a wilderness area, nor should it be generating revenue. So what we have done is we have tried to strike a deal with the National Forestry Department and to land swap, sell the 86,000 acres in the Boundary Water Canoe area. And we passed a House resolution, and we are continuing to work with the National Forestry Department. And one third of that land, when we do swap it, we are trying to have it as a sub-goal, is to try to consolidate some of the school trust lands to make the management of them more efficient.
I think we have Pages visiting us. I would believe that's correct. Pages, would you stand up? These are our high school Pages this week. And very quickly, starting here on my right, would you say your name and the area from which you are visiting us? Thank you very much for coming to visit us. We're actually talking about land that you own. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to invest it better so that there's more going into the school fund for you, for your education. So thank you very much for joining us. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good segue into my question, I think. I would like to piggyback on what Representative Murdoch was talking about regarding the value of the land. And my thoughts are more towards the mineral rights. I think in the literature I received, the school kids of our state received about $22 million in 2010 related to profits or proceeds from the state lands. How much of that was mineral rights? And then also, do we know what the present value of all the minerals we might own are? And in regards to possibly making those minerals more productive in the short term, given the funding issues we have in our state?
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, Representative, I forget your first question, but the second. How much of it was mineral in 2009? I don't know the exact percentage. It's probably up there around 90% of the revenues that go into the school trust fund are from minerals. As far as the, do we know the value of the minerals? We don't know the value of all the mineral resources. A lot of it is unexplored. We don't know necessarily where all the minerals are at and things like that. So it's just difficult for us to value. So we couldn't give a certain value on that.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's an excellent question. In 2009, if $22 million went to the permanent school fund, $22 million of it was minerals, because in 2009, the DNR, the students earned $10 million worth of revenue off of the forestry land. But unfortunately, every penny of it practically was used for expenses on behalf by the DNR. So $10 million in forestry, $200,000 was deposited to the permanent school fund. So basically all of it was minerals.
Representative Barrett, follow up.
Yeah, if I could, Madam Chair, thank you. If I could give some advice to the advisory committee, I think it would be important to find out what the value is of this of these minerals. How can we manage that property, that asset, if we don't know what the value is? I think so that we can properly allocate that money yearly to our kids in our state who currently have very serious funding issues. So, thank you.
Mr. Rourke, do you want to respond to that? Because I think you already did, but it's difficult, is it not, to know the value until we actually discover where the minerals are?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, there's a lot of exploration going on, so we are starting to get a better sense of the value of the minerals, particularly up in northeastern Minnesota where there is some school trust land. There was a document that the DNR put out that speculated that, I think it was put out in 2008, talking about the non-ferrous metallic minerals, the copper, nickel, gold, and silver, and things like that. And the number that was estimated in there is that over a 25-year lifespan of a mine, or if you could get some mines open in the state of Minnesota, you could possibly generate, the number we put in there was $1.4 billion That's based on the rents and royalty, which is a percentage of the value in the ground of those minerals.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I have a question. Years ago, I carried some legislation dealing with the university's land. We've been talking about school trust land. That's also large land holdings. It's now used, when I say I carried it, we used to take it as an offset, just like we did with the school trust lands, and then we allowed the university to use that for matching funds for endowed chairs. But my question is, who manages the university lands, and how does the return on their investment compare with what happens with the school trust lands? Because I think you might have a bit of a measurement there in terms of how DNR is handling those two. I think DNR handles those lands, but I'm not positive.
Mr. Bark.
And Representative Carlson. That's correct that the DNR does manage those lands. We manage for the minerals and the timber and the leases and the licenses and the easements, the same that we do with the school trust. And the comparison, if you look at the acreage on the university trust lands within the past years, and I don't get involved as much with the university trust lands, you'll see that the revenues compared to the acreage on the university trust land is higher than on the school trust, but that's because the university trust lands out of luck, they've got a lot of their acres right on top of the iron formation, so they're able to get a lot of royalties off of that. Within the past few years, I believe they've been mining the university trust lands, so there'll be years where they're doing that. I don't know if you're asking, and I don't know the answer if you are, as to who invests once the revenues are generated off the land. Who then invests that? I'm not sure if State Board of Investment does that or not.
Yeah, my question was on the management side and the return that those lands get relative to the school trust lands. I think that would maybe give us a bit of a benchmark, but as you point out, there may be some differences in terms of, you pointed out iron ore is on much of their land. I guess that would be my only question right now as to how those investments compare.
Representative Barrett?
Chair, I do have a follow-up when I think about it.
Representative
Carlson.
Who
manages that trust land then, or DNR manages it, but the oversight, is that simply the Board of Regents?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Bark.
There is no advisory committee for the university trust lands. I suppose that there's no formal advisory committee. I suppose the Board of Regents could provide us with advice on how to manage them, but there is no formal committee.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson, last night at the 8th Congressional Caucus for Regents, Representative Dill and Representative Rukavina knew the figures for the permanent trust fund land for the university. You might check with them because they knew what was generated, I believe it was last year. And I do remember Crookston got about $140,000, I believe, and I think Morris received $200,000. And UMD and the University of Minnesota's amounts were larger. I know the university's was in the millions, but it was the low millions. So they do know. And I'm sorry I didn't memorize those numbers. We had this little contest going on because the regents were asked if they understood what the acronym meant for the university trust fund land. So we had a little contest, and then Representative Rukavina gave some numbers.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that that's helpful. What I really was asking was how the return on the land itself compared.
Absolutely,
let's say,
yes.
A similar acreage that might be iron ore, if the school trust land is getting the same return as
that's an excellent
the university.
Question.
We do know they get a fair amount of money that they distribute. That's right. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, we do have those numbers for the university land, the acreage and the revenue, so we could produce that as well. So,
Thank you.
Is there anyone else from the public? Ms. Kelleher, did you want to comment on the land exchange that might be in process to add to this discussion? Or is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against Bill number 206? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kelleher. Say your name for the record and tell us a little bit about this land exchange that Representative Dietrich referred to.
Madam Chairman, my name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I would like to thank the godmother over here of school trust fund lands, maybe the fairy godmother, for her time, dedication, and endless effort in this area. And I hope this gives you all just a feeling sort of on the edge about the story that's really told with these lands and how they've been managed. And we have a huge challenge in front of us going forward. The bill you've got in front of you today, House File 206, talks actually fix some inherent problems we just had transferring the knowledge as we had majorities change in the body, and we want to make sure that that is not lost again. But the kind of questions Representative Carlson asked and Representative Barrett asked really get to the meat. I hope, Madam Chairman, you'll give us a bit of time to go through it. But there's possible good news for K-12 all across this gamut, one of which is the BWCA exchange with the federal government. And the DNR and the Federal Forestry Service have been looking at parcels to exchange, so they're thinking about two-thirds in cash and one-third in land. That one-third would be about 32,000 new acres for school trust fund lands to make money off of, and about $100 million or so in cash. That's an estimate. The feds do an appraisal 6 months before they would actually take over the land. So it's a loose number. But that would really bring an infusion of cash into it and better management. There's a bunch of different ways that we can drive this, and certainly with the excitement we're feeling in committee, we could go over this in detail, maybe during our own hearing. Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Are there any questions for Ms. Kelleher? With that, Representative Dietrich, do you want to return to the table? And
thank you, Madam Chair. In closing, I would just like to comment that obviously there has been a new energy around the school trust lands in the past 2 years. The advisory committee has been extremely active and spending a lot of time on this issue. And we just feel like the addition of these three members would be a good addition to the advisory committee. With that, I want to also make sure that I provide the caveat that I don't think this is the solution to the school trust lands management issue and to getting the most revenue for our students that is possible. There are, I think, in my opinion, better solutions, and I hope that we have the opportunity to converse about those yet this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich, and thank you, Mr. Rourke. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 206, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. This bill is moved to Government Operations. Thank you very much. With that, committee, we're going to move to some information that I've asked Lisa Larson to prepare for us as we get ready for an informational meeting on assessments. And so you have before you some short subjects that she has prepared that she will review for us. And then, members, we're going to move into some old legislation. Probably I shouldn't say old because it's been revised periodically. But it's the Planning Evaluation Reporting to Public. And it's something that I was involved in a long, long time ago and have this concern that we're leaving parents out. So we'll get to that as an overview after Ms. Larson talks or gives us an overview of the school assessment statute. So, Ms. Larson, yes, why don't you go to the front? That way we can address our questions to you. and thank you, Ms. Larson, for doing all this for us and preparing these or pulling up these short subject reports that you've done over the years. Welcome to our committee testifying table. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Lisa Larson. I work for House Research. In your packets, you should have a number of publications that our office does on a variety of topics. In this case, the short subjects you have before you relate to assessment in one form or another. In addition, I believe you also have a very old Citizens League report from 1972 and a comparison, a side-by-side accounting of the PER law that the chair referenced a moment ago as it was enacted and as it currently exists in statute. In preparing for this, I was trying to think how best to characterize the differences between what we've got currently and the PER law that the chair mentioned, and I think perhaps one way to look at it is this. The assessment system that we have currently today is largely informed by federal requirements. In the past number of years, the legislature has tried to overlay a number of additional aspects or facets of assessment that were intended to supplement and in some ways overcome some of the shortcomings of the federal law. The PER law, as we have it, and you'll see from the Citizens League report, was something that was entirely created by citizens of the state of Minnesota. So what I'd like to do first, per the chair's request, is to review for you the structure of our current assessment system, which is largely informed by federal requirements, and then to take a little bit of time to look at what the citizens of Minnesota thought was necessary in terms of an assessment system that would serve the needs of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. I just want to interrupt for a minute to let the students know that we're now talking about the testing. If you're in public school or in charter school, you may, for sure in public school, be taking the MCAs, and that's what you're going to hear our house researcher tell us about. And I know you know all about No Child Left Behind, so stay tuned so that you understand this a little better. Ms. Larson, proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you. What I'm going to do is simply outline the assessment requirements that pertain to our state system. As I mentioned, they largely result from federal mandates, but there is an overlay of state requirements as well. Minnesota, and this is reflected in the PER documents that you look at, was historically a local control state. And it was the school districts in the state that developed school accountability measures initially. What we've got now is a system that requires both the implementation of federal as well as state education requirements. Under No Child Left Behind, there are prescriptions regarding what school and districts must do in terms of accountability as well as the timelines to satisfy those requirements. Therefore, schools and districts, in order to improve students' performance, must achieve specific performance targets. There is a requirement that all students participate in these large-scale statewide assessments. There is a public reporting requirement, and there are consequences that flow to both schools and districts that fail to meet the performance mandates. One of the perceived strengths of the federal No Child Left Behind requirement is that it applies to all students and subgroups of students. And perhaps this is, in fact, one of its great strengths, because the federal law requires all schools to determine whether all students and subgroups of students, including limited English proficient students, students with disabilities, students eligible for free and reduced price meals, and white, black, Asian, Pacific Islander, American Indian, and Hispanic students are making adequate yearly progress. Interestingly, from the standpoint of the schools in terms of how this federal law works, it behooves students to have fewer identified subgroups counted within a school because then there would be fewer chances to fail to make adequate yearly progress. Schools that fail to make adequate yearly progress by failing to meet or sustain levels of performance for all students and for each individually identified student subgroup would be labeled as failing.
Also, if schools fail to make schools would fail to make AYP adequate yearly progress if fewer than 95% of all the students in each identified subgroup were tested. So clearly, what happened here is that all of a sudden a light was being shined on the performance of individual subgroups rather than students as a whole. Minnesota's graduation requirements encompass both course credits as well as testing requirements, so that in order to graduate from a Minnesota public school, students have to meet state course credit requirements and testing requirements, and then any additional requirements that the local districts impose. The students must take reading and math, MCAs, Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, not only to graduate, but to satisfy federal testing requirements. The reading and math, MCAs, are used in Minnesota to meet the No Child Left Behind requirements and also to measure student progress toward achieving state academic standards. What you have to understand about this system is that it's a system premised on the notion that we are going to decide whether kids have met a designated level of performance, specifically in reading and math. We also have a state writing test in ninth grade, but it's the reading and math mandated at the federal by the federal law that is our primary focus. And student scores on the reading and math MCAs determine whether schools and districts are making sufficient, adequate yearly progress. This is about meeting a performance standard. This is not about diagnosing issues related to how students are learning, the strengths or weaknesses of the curriculum, the strengths or weaknesses of the instruction. The system that we've got is not intended for that purpose. Tests are designed for specific purposes. The tests that we administer currently as a result of federal mandate are about measuring whether kids have attained a specific level of performance in reading and math. They are not intended to be diagnostic. In addition to the reading and math tests, there are also science tests that are required. They are not part of the federal adequate yearly progress calculation, but they are required. So a science exam under the federal law must be administered to students in grades 3 to 5, 6 to 9, and 10 to 12. Students do not need to pass the high school science exam, the MCA, to graduate. And as a matter of fact, the state law prohibits the education commissioner from requiring students to receive a passing score on a high school science assessment as a condition of receiving a diploma. Minnesota students take MCA exams in reading in grades 3 through 8 and 10. They take the math exams in grades 3 through 8 and 11, and the science exams in grades 5 and 8, and once in high school, depending on when they complete the life sciences curriculum. Minnesota requires students to pass reading and math tests to graduate. The MCA scores allow Minnesota to comply with the federal requirements. However, embedded in those MCAs are something called the grad tests. We have grad reading and math test items that students pass in order to graduate. The grad scores and the MCA scores are reported separately. So in order to graduate, a student must either first achieve at or above what we've determined to be proficiency on the reading MCAs that are first administered in 10th grade, on the math MCAs that are first administered in 11th grade, or achieve a passing score on the grad tests in reading and math that are embedded in the MCAs. A 2009 law allows students who enrolled in grade 8 in any school year from the 2005-2006 school year to the 2009-2010 school year who do not pass the 11th grade math test to receive a high school diploma if certain things are true. If they receive a passing score or grade on all state and local coursework that is required for graduation, if they participate in academic remediation in math, and take two math grad retests or one math grad retest. And this is true for kids who graduate through the 2013-2014 school year. To illustrate the argument for why the legislature enacted this, in 2009-2010 school year, 64% of white students passed the 11th grade math assessment, either the MCA or the grad test, while only 23% of black students passed that same assessment. There are also, in our testing system, provisions for both special education students and LEP students. Students with individual education programs and significant cognitive disabilities can take the Minnesota Test of Academic Skills, called the MTAS, instead of the GRAD reading and math test. And you should be aware that the MCAs are administered only one time per year, but the GRAD tests are administered multiple times per year, so that if a student does not receive a passing score on that MCA that is administered one time, there are other opportunities during the course of the year to pass. Eligible students with disabilities are also able to take the alternative assessment for writing. With respect to limited English proficient students, they must pass the GRAD test if they have been enrolled in any Minnesota school for at least 4 consecutive school years. Limited English proficient students who first enroll in a Minnesota school in grade 9 or above and who complete all other state and local high school graduation requirements within 4 years are not required to pass the GRAD test in order to graduate. And this gets us to what it is that we're actually measuring. In 2008, the legislature passed a bill that proposed to add something called student growth onto the school report card. It was vetoed in 2008, but a very similar bill was passed and enacted in 2009. Part of the debate about growth had to do with the federal law. The federal law does not allow a value-added growth model for federal accountability, because federal accountability is all about measuring whether students have met a particular standard of performance. The growth model does not require all students to become proficient in reading and math by the 2013-2014 school year, which is what the current federal law requires. However, the federal law does not prevent a state from using a value-added growth model for state accountability. And that's where we have enacted additional provisions that some might say supplement what the federal law currently requires. NCLB requires student subgroups to demonstrate adequate yearly progress. And one of the underlying purposes of that requirement is to try to close the academic achievement gap. What happens when student subgroups fail to make AYP is that there are consequences not only to the students, but also to the schools, so that federal resources get redirected in those schools where student subgroups are not making the required adequate yearly progress. The federal law requires schools to use certain what we call student performance indicators in order to measure whether they are making AYP. These performance indicators include reading and math proficiency, which we've talked about, students' participation rates on the reading and math assessments, high school graduation rates, and an additional K-8 indicator, which is attendance. Schools where enough additional students in identified subgroups fail to make proficiency or demonstrate proficiency on reading and math for 2 consecutive school years or more acquire the status of failing schools and become, depending on the number of years this is true, subject to increasingly severe sanctions. The way academic achievement is used to calculate AYP is designed to show what students have achieved at one point in time on state reading and math tests based on state academic standards of proficiency. This is success in terms of how many students in a particular group can show that they are proficient, that they have met a particular level of performance on state tests. The
critics of this measure have said that this particular measure is affected by demographic and other factors that are outside the school. And what this particular measure also doesn't show is what students' rate of progress toward actually achieving proficiency might be. So in failing to take into account students' initial performance levels, a lot of people have said that No Child Left Behind is not really a full picture of what transpires. Schools are being judged in part, they say, by how much knowledge students bring into the schools. It also means that different schools are subject to different standards because some schools must show only small academic gains to achieve proficiency, while other schools must show very large academic gains. This is where the idea for a complementary growth measure came into play. Unlike proficiency, which is one point in time, growth measure uses the same data to generate proficiency to determine how much academic growth or progress a student makes between two points in time. This measure can demonstrate success by how much a student learned compared with other students in similar circumstances. It is argued that this measure is largely independent of demographic and other factors outside of the school and more dependent upon what happens in school. That is the reason why there is interest in having schools use value-added growth data to try to estimate the impact of curriculum, instruction, programs, and practices on students' rate of academic growth, both progress for individual students as well as groups of students. People who advocate for the growth model, and Minnesota has one now, say that it can be used to measure the relative effectiveness of schools based on students' initial achievement and then their subsequent achievement. They say it is a better measure to determine schools' impact on student progress. So that, for example, schools where you have low initial achievement levels and high growth, and schools where you have high initial achievement levels and high growth can provide models for other schools. Such information can be used, arguably, to modify instruction and align professional development to better meet students' needs. And that kind of leads us, if I may, to that 1972 Citizens League report.
But Ms. Lesson, I'm going to interrupt just a second to see, does anyone have a question for clarification before we proceed to this document where we have a side-by-side? Very good. Ms. Larson, proceed.
Yeah. Before we look at the Citizens League report, I would like to give you some context. And that is that in the early 1970s, there was a perception that a need exists that schools and districts needed to be more responsive to both the teachers within the districts and to the public that they served. This interest in accountability had both public as well as political motives behind it. There was a perception that we needed an educational accountability system that would be results-oriented so that teachers and administrators would have feedback to improve the system, that the public would be able to link expenditures with outcomes, and that the public would also have the opportunity to provide meaningful input into the educational system. At that time, students had very limited options, very few. There was a compulsory attendance law. There was the curriculum was limited. Attendance boundaries were fixed. And the public participation in the system was somewhat limited. So in gathering together to provide this report, and I see one of the original signers to the report actually sitting in the audience now, there was a desire to set up an accountability system that would serve educators as well as the public. And the tension here is that there was a perception at that time that Minnesota's education system was one of the best in the country. And it's hard to institute change when people feel satisfied that the system they got
they had was a very good one. However, there were voices that claimed that the education system was not meeting the needs of individual students, and also schools were not well geared to accommodate lots of parent involvement. And now, if I may, if I could ask you, in your packet, you have a copy of that old Citizens League report from 1972. And if you would be kind enough, I'd like to just kind of skim through it with you. I don't know if you're going to be as surprised as I was at what you find here, but I have to say I found it a rather remarkable document. So, for example, if you'd be kind enough to turn to page 2 of that document, you can see that there on page 2, they've got a list of some of the items that provided the impetus for this report in the first place. There was a suggestion that that the schools did not adequately teach students how to think for themselves. There was an observation that bond elections were increasingly difficult to pass. There was another perception that schools, for the most part, were not geared to accommodate high levels of parent participation. Then if you turn to page 5, there are some interesting discussions about what this program should be all about. There is discussion about the need for longitudinal data on student performance. There is an emphasis on reading and math. There is a desire to use state assessment data for diagnosing strengths and weaknesses in the education system and for prioritizing the system's needs in order to best allocate limited resources. On page 6, there is a discussion about the need to equalize educational resources. Farther down on that page, you'll see a discussion on the focus on reading. On page 7, here you see another discussion. It's about looking at academic growth through formative assessments in order to inform instruction to enable students and teachers to see how students' achievement can grow. Down at the bottom of that same page, there are references to the importance of parent involvement. On page 8, you'll see this is before open enrollment and PSEO, long before it, and you see a list of enrollment options tailored to students' needs and interests proposed at that time. So, for example, there are 5 here. One would be a teacher-directed structured curriculum. A second would be team teaching that allows each student to advance at his own pace without regard to grade level. A third option was an open school with a flexible curriculum. A fourth option was a free school where curriculum was structured to contain what those who teach and learn wish to develop and experience. And a fifth option, which was done, I think, in conjunction with the university, was the Marshall University High School, that proposed to offer a flexible array of courses and activities. On page 8, there is a discussion about how these different options might serve different kinds of students, and how those students might benefit from all these options, and how the options might be structured. There is a reference in the middle of that page to talking about one of the benefits perceived in this whole proposal, and that would be to effectively mix students of different racial, socioeconomic, and ability backgrounds in a meaningful educational program. On page 11, there is a diagnosis of the problem that schools are failing to maximize individual student achievement. On page 12, there is a discussion of the current forms of accountability. They are these: school board elections, school bond elections, the public's ability to organize, and this is clearly in the age before Twitter, choice of where families choose to live, and the alternative of private schools. This whole drive toward improvements is born of 2 considerations. One, the reality of limited resources, and 2, the desire for excellence. This group proposed to define accountability in 3 ways: to measure the resources and results, to generate parent involvement, and three, to foster professional development. On page 13, you see a discussion about the clamor for both fiscal and programmatic accountability, hand in hand. On page 14, it says that the whole point of accountability is to focus on schools. And that's, I think, one of the interesting parallels between No Child Left Behind and what was written 40 years ago. No Child Left Behind was also premised on the notion of accountability for schools. And to some degree, it's true, because schools that and districts that fail to make AYP are labeled as failing. However, the system has evolved so that quite a significant burden has also fallen to the students themselves. So those who fail to pass or meet the levels of proficiency we've defined cannot graduate. So we have quote-unquote failing schools, and then we have failing students. On page 15, there is a discussion about annual performance reports and the use of multiple indicators. This was a debate that the legislature has engaged in the last number of years to try to supplement the all-or-nothing structure of No Child Left Behind. There is a discussion about focusing on individual students, a recommendation for annual assessments of progress toward defined goals at the local level. There is a proposal for legislation for collaborative goal setting and evaluation. And the collaborative goal setting would involve both the professional staff as well as the community in determining measurable goals for improving student learning. Later on page 16, there is a proposal for a Center for Management Assistance. I'm not going to go into that because that's not completely on point to the parallel between what was proposed then and the current system that we have, but note that that was part of this proposal. If you look on page 17, there is a focus on specific objectives that become the key to curriculum planning. On page 18, there is an important point that they made then, and I would say is equally relevant today. If you would be kind enough to look at the last underlined two sentences in the second paragraph. Measurability should not be confused with desirability. Neither should goal setting and assessment be ignored because the precise measures are not available. Emphasis should be placed both on measuring what is planned to be accomplished and continuing to stress some objectives that cannot be measured very well. And to the extent that you subscribe to the notion that there are 21st century skills that are very valuable but not easily susceptible to measurement, arguably what they've written here applies today too. Later on this page, you see the recommendation regarding public involvement, public meetings, soliciting community response, and encouraging participation. On page 19, there is a recommendation for a diagnostic data system. And on that page, you see a discussion of what the Hopkins School District set in place, something called a Process of Continuing Achievement Monitoring, CAM. And this was very forward at the time and highly discussed. On page 20, you see a discussion of the role of the school boards in this entire. On page 25, here's another topic that may or may not appear during this session, and it has to do with a differentiated system of staffing with proposals for new and improved staffing patterns. One of the aspects of this was a proposal for multi-year contracts for school administrators who were perceived to be very important in terms of the role they played in the overall performance of schools. On page 26, they answer the question, why not vouchers?
On page 27, they cast this notion of assessments in the context of leading to improved use of resources. So assessments really were not just about measuring how well a student is doing, but they were also intended to help policymakers at the state as well as local level better use existing and finite resources. This also went on to say that widespread standardized tests, which were in fact widely used at that time, were not the same as providing for an evaluation of school performance. So this system was designed to supplement the widespread administration of standardized tests with an attempt to understand what was occurring at the school level. Now, I found this rather interesting. On page 29, they went on to discuss why education is not a federal function. And if you look right at the second paragraph, it says, nowhere in the federal constitution can there be found any reference to education, and that it is the Minnesota legislature that is charged with establishing a general and uniform system of public schools. Down at the bottom of the page, you'll see a reference to the Minnesota Miracle, which was all about equalizing state public aid to school districts. On page 31, there's a discussion about the very important role of classroom teachers in this whole learning process. On page 32, there was some discussion about what to do about the rigidity of school management and how this system might be used to make it less rigid and more facile. And so, Madam Chair, I think in looking at this report, you might find that some of the points raised here are in fact relevant today. And that brings us to the last piece of paper here, and that is, it's a side-by-side of the law as it was originally introduced and the law that currently exists. And I do know that in the past number of years, as there have been interests in reducing the mandates on school districts, this PER law, as it exists now in a much reduced state, has often, if not always, been on that list of proposed mandates to be repealed because the law is not being implemented. And if you would be willing, I'd like to go through with you just very briefly how that law, as it was originally envisioned, was structured. So on the first page, on the left-hand column, which is the original law, you see that the purpose is laid out. What is the purpose? Continued improvement of the educational program for all public school children in the state. Secondly, better evaluation of educational programs by local communities. And thirdly, to facilitate decisions by school boards and communities about which services can best be provided by public schools and which services can best be provided by other institutions, including the family, private sector, and other public agencies. And then to section 2 on the next page, it requires a written policy so that each school board is required to develop and adopt a written educational policy that states educational goals for the district, a process for achieving those goals, and procedures for evaluating and reporting the progress toward those goals. And the whole point of this, or the expectation, was that these goals and any revisions to the policies would be accomplished after the board consulted with staff in each school building within the state. Subdivision 2 talks about the instructional plan for the school district as well as schools and the measurable objectives that were part of that plan. So the requirement was for an instructional plan for the purpose of implementing goals within the resources that were available to the district. The instructional plan was supposed to include measurable instructional objectives, that were intended to assist in directing and measuring progress toward district goals parallel or to supplement the educational policy. There was a recognition that some goals would not be easily measurable and that the instructional plan would include other appropriate means to direct and evaluate the progress of these kinds of goals not easily susceptible to measure. Subdivision 3 of the original law provided for a curriculum advisory committee. There was a direction to the school board to appoint or encouragement to the school board to appoint a curriculum advisory committee that would provide for active community participation in developing and revising the district educational policy, developing an instructional plan, evaluating progress, and reporting to the public. Subdivision 4 required an annual professional and consumer evaluation. So there, each year there would be a final evaluation of progress that would be conducted both in terms of what the professionals perceived and what the community perceived. The professional staff evaluation was meant to include test results and other performance data, as well as faculty interpretations and judgments. The consumer evaluation was meant to include opinions of students, parents, and community residents. And each school board, after receiving these reports, was directed to review the results and develop appropriate school improvement plans to improve the areas where the goals of the district had not been met. Subdivision 5 set out a reporting requirement, and of course we've got one today. We've got a school report card requirement in law that requires each school and district to report on the data that we generate under our current testing system. But here in this 1976 law, there was also a requirement for public reporting, so that the district's educational policy, the reports of annual evaluation, including summary test results, and plans for school improvement would be made available to all the districts. And then it goes on to set up a process in order to assist school districts with all of this, because it was a considerable amount of work to accomplish this law. So the state, as well as, I think there were 9, if I'm not mistaken, EXUs, a series of regional entities that were charged with assisting the districts in developing and maintaining the operation of this policy. And ultimately, they were charged with providing district with technical assistance. This was set up to do many things useful to the district specifically, but it was also intended, upon the request of districts, to provide cross-district comparisons. Finally, there was a provision that would allow the Department of Education to assist with testing requirements at the request of individuals.
Representative McFarland has a question to this point.
Thank you. Are you referring to the service cooperatives?
Yes.
In that? Okay.
Yes.
Because I don't think everybody knew what EXU meant.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, you are correct. Those are the service co-ops. Yes.
Madam Chair. And those are still in effect today, correct?
Yes. There are
some of them.
Yeah, there are fewer of them.
Fewer.
Yeah. Yes, Madam Chair.
Ms. Larson.
Yeah. And Madam Chair,
Well, now, see, this was very exciting and interesting for me because I lived through this. And at first I was a stay-at-home mom when they started these discussions, and I participated. And then I returned to the classroom and went through this whole process. So, of course, when mandate relief keeps cropping up, and I'm here in the legislature, I keep hanging on to it because I see a value in this. But I did ask Joe Nathan, who was on this report, the Citizens League reporting group, to make a few comments to us about how he remembers and how he sees this played out today. But in my estimation, members, this is one way to keep our parents and our citizenry involved. And if we let go of this, and I know it's probably in one or two mandate relief proposals, I know it's on the superintendent's list, I'm afraid if we let go of this, we have lost our contact with parents' ability to weigh in on several matters. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nathan. And before you begin, thank you very much, Ms. Larson. You did an insurmountable amount of work in putting this together. And for me, it was very valuable. And I hope it'll lead to some discussions later as we proceed to prepare for our omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nathan. Please identify yourself and proceed to make some comments.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change at McAllister College. I've been involved as a parent, teacher, administrator, PTA president, and in a variety of other roles since the fall of 1970 in Minnesota. And our three children all attended and graduated from public schools. My wife has recently retired after 33 years as a public school teacher, and our two of our children work for a local public school system. I want to thank the chair for encouraging us to take a look 38 years back at what people were thinking then, and I want to make a few comments about this law and what it might mean for 2011 and the future. First, I want to commend Ms. Larson, as is she did her typically fantastic job of summarizing briefly and succinctly a good deal of work. So I want to, as one of the people who worked on the committee, I want to thank you for the fine work that once again you did in doing in that. I want to make 4 points about the report and then talk about possible future implications. First, one can see in this report a number of things that developed over a series of years in this state. There are a number of ideas here that later were more fully fleshed out. One of them is the idea of what does it mean to be accountable? And we had huge debates in this committee, as we've had in this state, about does accountability mean just to report, or does it mean to be responsible for? And those are two different definitions of accountability. And I think that those definitions of accountability can go together. My own view, and I believe it's shared by a number of members of the committee of both parties, is that accountability does not mean just a report. It means to be responsible for. And I think that we have increasingly moved toward an understanding that schools, particularly schools if they are effective in working with communities, can be and should be expected to not only report the results, but be responsible for improving student achievement. So I want to be clear that that was a tension or certainly a discussion point then, and I think it should be a discussion point now. I believe, as you know from previous testimony that I've made, that I think that it is possible to expect schools to improve student achievement in a variety of ways, and I think that one of the principal things that the legislature can do is to encourage and assist this kind of thing. So the first of the 4 points has to do with the nature of accountability. The second has to do with the importance of periodic reporting to the public, and as the chair said, this was an explicit statement that that should happen. I think that any wise organization, whether it's private sector or public sector, reports to its constituencies about what progress it's making. And one of the concerns that the committee raised was that it was not really possible in 1972 to compare individual schools across the state and say which schools are doing well in terms of improving achievement and which are not. And in previous testimony, I pointed out that one of the things that we need to do in the future is to make more use of the schools, whether they're district or charter, in saying what's going well and what can we learn from that. So I think that this was a very important report in moving the state towards saying let's have more information about individual schools so that the schools that are doing well we can learn from, and the schools that are not doing so well can get some assistance. So I think that's the second key point. The third key point, and I won't belabor this, is that you can see in various places that one of the things that the committee talked a good deal about was allowing families choice among schools. And at this point, even though some of us were very strong supporters of it in 1972, the committee decided not to recommend that the legislature adopt what later became known as post-secondary options, which, by the way, has had a huge positive impact for more than 110,000 kids, and allowing high school students to take college courses while they're still in high school. I see every day I meet people who say, oh, I did that 15 years ago, I did that 20 years ago. Maybe that some of your own children have done that. But we are nationally known for the post-secondary options program. And that was something that on a bipartisan basis the legislature did in 1985. And it's also encouraged a number of high schools to offer more advanced placement, international baccalaureate, college in the schools program, so that we have literally thousands of kids who are taking more challenging classes. And I could say more about that, but won't. But clearly, if one looks carefully at the report, you will see at various points that the committee edges up to but does not recommend at that point, 1972. It did recommend 10 years later, but at that point it did not recommend that there be more public school choice in the state. You can also see that the committee had extensive discussions, which it did, about the voucher idea and ultimately decided on a very narrow vote not to recommend public funds being allowed to follow students to private and parochial schools, although the 10 years later, the post-secondary options law has allowed youngsters to take courses not only at public colleges and universities, but at private colleges, so long as the courses are not sectarian in nature. So that's one of the other issues that one can see here. Fourth, seems to me that the report is trying to say clearly that we need to have some focus, and we need to be we need to set priorities, and that's something that we've talked a bit about already in this committee, and it is something that I want to reiterate. I'm sorry, there is one fifth point that I want to make in the committee, which is very timely, and that's on page 33 of the report, in under the findings. On page 33 of the report, the last paragraph above D reads as follows. This is again on page 33. While there are procedures for removing tenured classroom teachers or administrators for such things as incompetency, inefficiency, or improper conduct, they are seldom used, and administrators can only be demoted for policy reasons if there is mutual agreement. And there's a lot to say about that one. I will just tell you briefly, my own recommendation is that everybody in education, early childhood, K through 12, colleges and universities, everybody should be periodically assessed. And it's not simply a matter of whether they should or should but not be tenure. I think tenure provides due process, and I'm a believer in due process, but I'm also a believer in assessment and accountability for schools and for individuals. And as you know, Madam Chair, I'm after 23 years at the University of Minnesota, I'm now at McAllister College, and by the way, my comments reflect only my own views and not those of McAllister College. But I do believe that everybody benefits in the private sector and the public sector from periodic assessment. And so one of the things that I urge that did not make the report was that we have a requirement of periodic assessment of all individuals working in a school system, whether they had been there 2 years, 5 years, 15 years, or 25 years. So those are a few brief comments, and I would, of course, be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nathan. Are there questions? Well, are there comments about the importance of this PER legislation, or are you believing that it should be put on the mandate relief list? Any comment, reaction to that? Ms. Representative McFarland.
I just thank you, Madam Chair. I just find this all very interesting, and I'm sometimes we need to look back in our history to see where we're going, why we're going there. I kind of wonder, what have we been doing for 40 years that's changed? It hasn't changed.
Representative McFarland, wandering in the wilderness. Because I recall, as a classroom teacher, how very important it was for us to have these meetings every year with parents to review curriculum, to talk about how we were teaching and what we were teaching in the classroom. And then parents always wondered to what extent we were using test results. Now, my school district used the Iowa Basic, which I took very seriously, and I looked at every test printout of my students before I began teaching English in the fall. I spent considerable time at the end of August getting permission to look at all the test results so I could see where students were in regard to being ready for, if I had ninth graders, ninth grade, or if I had juniors for junior English. And it was very important to me, but it seemed that it became so burdensome for us to have to pull all those files, and it was, unless you were willing to just take a lot of your own time and go through that. So we've come so far now in data collection. It's amazing. But there was importance to looking at those tests, and of course they were different from today, but at least they told me how my students were achieving and to what goals I should be moving them, whether it was in their reading or in something very specific in their understanding of the language. So I really appreciated it and clung to it, and really liked the fact that parents, you know, whether they were liking this or not, had a chance to weigh in. And so when I used the image this year of the three-legged stool, and parents are one of the legs, I have been reflecting on this PIRR legislation and knowing that if we keep this in law and perhaps even put a statement in our omnibus bill that districts, you should pay attention to this, we can bring parents back in to the fold because even as the Citizens League said, they were feeling left out. And when parents feel left out, they start complaining. And we've been hearing those complaints. And they're no different, really, from what they were in the 70s than what they are today. Parents are concerned, and I'm so glad they are. And we need to engage them. And so perhaps this is one way to do it. Are there further comments or questions for Mr. Nathan? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nathan, can you tell the committee, we've had a discussion about tenure and your fifth point there, and we had some discussion about the history of tenure for public school teachers. I'm wondering if you know about that, and was it instituted mainly for protection of academic freedom, or was it mainly economic things so that to protect them as they got more years of experience? Thank you.
Mr. Nathan.
Madam Chair, Representative, I have not studied the history of the adoption of this legislation, so I remember as a young public school teacher that it was being done as when I was a young public school teacher. And as is often the case, I think that there were multiple reasons for the legislature being encouraged to do this, and I do remember a conversation that then Senator Coleman and I had, and he was one of the chief authors of the legislation, and he and I talked about precisely the provision that I spoke to 2 minutes ago in saying my recommendation, which he actually liked, was that if we were going to have tenure, that we also ought to have the mandate for periodic assessment. And he, obviously, he's passed on now, so there's no way to verify that, but he liked that idea. And I continued to talk about that for 38 years. But I do think that it makes sense for two things to happen in terms of the way we treat teachers. Many things, but two things are. One, that teachers be afforded due process. And secondly, that there be the explicit expectation that periodically, and this is true in early childhood, K through 12, and higher education, that periodically the work that someone is being done should be assessed, and that she or he should be accountable for having to, every 5 years or so, have to show that there is evidence in using a variety of measures. So I think that we have provided due process, and I think due process is appropriate, but I don't think that we have gone the next step, which is to say, okay, but part of what we have to do here is not only provide due process, but make sure that assessments are taking place. Because I've been at a number of meetings of this committee over the last 30 years where teachers come in and say, well, nobody's really assessed them over many years. And we get into this debate about how much does the legislature have to mandate and how much should just be best practice. So I think that one of the values of this, as the chairperson just said, was that there is should be the expectation on the part of the legislature that periodically the school districts take a look at what they're doing, and then going to your question, take a look at individual teachers. So I think that there is a value to reminding school district that this is the expectation, and I think there's a value to saying yes to due process and yes to periodic assessment, both. Otherwise, people get very busy. There are many demands on people working in schools, and some things that are desirable don't necessarily happen. I recognize, having worked with schools in schools as a teacher and administrator, that your people are very busy and they're reluctant to be told you have to do this. But I think best practice is that you do plan, that you do evaluate, that you plan with the people with whom you're working, that's including the faculty and the families, and that you do report. And obviously, I think that we should be expecting periodic assessment, not only of the overall schools, but also the people who work in the schools.
Ms. Larson's going to shed some light on the tenure law.
Madam Chair, members, as with all legislation, there are complex interests and at play, but one of the interests in affecting tenure had to do with financing. And when budgets were tight, there sometimes was an interest in having the most expensive teachers go, because that provided an opportunity to trim the budget in a way that in some ways
affected the fewest number of individuals. And so one of the motives for the teacher tenure law was to ensure that simply because a teacher was more experienced and then therefore more highly paid, it would not be on that basis alone that a decision would be made to ask that teacher to leave.
And Ms. Larson, when was tenure created? Was it in the 30s? I think it was in the late 30s or early 40s when tenure, at least I think in Minneapolis, and maybe Ms. Gilbert, do you know? Have you tracked that at all, when tenure? I think we have an answer here from Representative Myrod. Have you tracked that?
Madam Chair, Adam did a research project for me and took it back looking into 1920s.
Oh, the 20s. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, yes. And was that Minneapolis first? Because I believe they had the first tenure law, because we have separate tenure laws for cities of the first class from the rest of our school districts.
Yes.
Ms. Myra?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Nathan.
Madam Chair, members, just very briefly, some of these, I completely agree with what Ms. Larson said, that that was one of the reasons. And some of these expectations were codified in something that became known as the PELRA, Public Employee Labor Relations Act.
Does anyone else want to address this, these issues? Anyone in the public have some comment to make or some knowledge or background to share with us? Well, thank you very much, Ms. Larson, Mr. Nathan. Of course, Representative Dietrich is gone, but we learned a lot from her and from Jason Rourke from the DNR. Very productive meeting. This meeting is adjourned.